So I thought I'd talk for a bit and hopefully, if this goes well, leave time for a discussion. It's quite, I can't remember how I, if I suggested talking about this, but I don't know how I've ended up trying to talk about narrative and define narrative. Or maybe that's just the stupid task I set myself. But I'm going to broadly talk about narrative and lyric. And I found the only way to try and make sense of what narrative, you know, when you spend enough time like looking at a single point in the wall or a single word, you just go crazy. So the more I thought about narrative, the more kind of impossible it was to define. So I'm going to talk about narrative and lyric. And I thought that the best place to start to talk about narrative would be to look at a lyric poem, because, you know, you can only taste a flaffle wrap when you've had a jelly baby. That is the principle by which I live. This is a poem I found online. And I think I just, it's just an anonymous poem I found in it, but it just seemed to speak to some of the things I was thinking about. Poem. She doesn't think about that as she walks back to town through the yellow-leafed streets with their autumn smells and silences, past Clover Point, the cliffs crowned with broom bushes, the mountains across the water, the mountains of the Olympic Peninsula assembled like a blatant backdrop, a cutout of rainbow tissue paper. She doesn't think about Francis or Peter or Clara or even Tom. She thinks about sitting in the store in the evenings, the light in the street, the complicated reflections in the windows, the accidental clarity. Yeah. So someone did the which I think is like the appropriate response to a lyric poem. Well, so these things are really difficult to write. So what everything I'm going to say is kind of conjectural and obviously eminently disagreeable with, hopefully not disagreeable in itself. So this to me feels like a lyric poem. It's short, it sings, but it also has some features of a narrative. So whereas lyric is often presented in the first person, I, it's personal, this is in the third person. And it has references to specific locations, to Clover Point, Olympic Peninsula, and specific persons, Francis, Peter, Clara. So we've got these characters. But if it coheres into anything resembling a narrative, and this is kind of a useful rule of thumb for me, I mean, imagine if it was on like Dawson's Creek or Coronation Street, it would only take up like half a second of screen time. You know, a woman walks back into town, mountains in the background, like cutscene. So it's not really, it couldn't really be described as a narrative in that sense. It doesn't have action, or the action that occurs for Aristotle, narrative is the imitation of an action, is internal. It's defined by these kind of swerves of thought, the repetition of she doesn't think, she doesn't think. So she doesn't think about Francis, Peter, Clara. She doesn't think about, what's the next one? She doesn't think about that at the beginning. She doesn't think about Francis, Peter, Clara. So this swerving thought line as well, where the action is internal, also feels characteristic to the lyric. Makes me think of one of the oldest lyric poets, Sappho. As the sweet apple reddens on a high branch, high on the highest branch, and the apple pickers forgot, no, not forgot, were unable to reach. That the action, I mean, obviously it's a tiny fragment, but the action of the poem is this swerve of thought away, the no, not forgot. You know, if you don't have that change of direction, then what is this? It's not, you know, it's not about the description, it's about the swerve. And also at the end of the poem, as indicated by the which I would have done myself, is this implication of an epiphany. Okay? So, which is also emphasized by the short sentence without a subject or verb, the accidental clarity. So perhaps this is the moment when the speaker realizes that she's not thinking about Francis, Peter, Clara, or Tom. Perhaps everything has been about them. Or perhaps she realizes in remembering those reflections in the windows in an old shop that the accidental clarity of things emerges in their absence rather than their presence. Okay, so to sum up what I think of as a lyric poem, and with bearing this poem in mind, I think one of the most useful thinkers on the lyric is Helen Vendler. So she's the Porter University Professor Emerita at Harvard, and she's famous for having written about Seamus Heaney and Wallace Stevens and others. And she wrote this introduction to a book of hers called Soul Says, which is kind of amazing. It's just the most strident definition of what a lyric is. And I tried to condense her rules for lyric into some principles. And these are all direct quotes. And again, so I know this is about narrative poetry. I'm going to try and keep this moving. But yeah. In lyric poetry, voice is made abstract. That is, the range of things one would normally know about a voice in a novel, one does not know about a voice in a lyric. The voice of the soul itself. Souls are independent of time and space. That's important to her, that the lyric is the voice of the soul, whereas the narrative is the voice of the self. So spontaneity, intensity, circumstantiality, a sudden freeze frame of disturbance, awakening pang, an urgent inviting rhythm. It's surprising. It has compression. The lyric is the gesture of immortality and freedom, whereas the novel is historical and spatial. And this is an interesting one. The lyric is indexical, not exhaustive. It mentions, and the reader is left to expand the mention to the whole arc of experience of which the mention is the sign. So like in the beginning of that poem, she doesn't think about that. Or even those references to places, they're kind of indexical, and we like expand out our sense of the poem from them. And the voices in lyric are represented not by characters as in a novel or drama, but by changing registers of diction, contrastive rhythms, and varieties of tone. So from that, you can kind of take a silhouetted set of rules for what she would say a narrative constitute. Ooh, sorry, that's a typo. This is her rules. These are her rules for narrative, by implication. So in narrative poetry then, based on this idea, this popular idea of the lyric, because we more commonly think about the lyric rather than the narrative, in narrative poetry, the voice is concrete and embodied. We know things about who's speaking and what they look like. We also know why they're speaking. We have characters, a plot. And narrative poems present us with the voice not of the soul, but of the self, which is mortal and exists in history. And the rhythm of fiction, this is a quote from her, is long-breathed and deliberate in pursuit. So it's considered, careful, contingent, gradually dawning. So I don't know about the people in this room, but a lot of people have like strong feelings about lyric and narrative. A lot of people feel like a strong tug towards lyric and a strong antipathy towards narrative. A lot of people feel a strong antipathy towards lyric, this idea that it's just like the epiphanic eye. And for me, it is often looking at Wendler. I mean, Wendler's an amazing critic. I think this is, it's quite like a, it's fairly, it's like an enthusiastic piece of writing about lyric. But it brings out, I think, some of the reasons why people react so badly to these terms, because they can become kind of cartoonish. And this is kind of what I'm going to hopefully be reacting against and giving a slightly more different take to. So, for example, poets like Bruce Andrews in the US, a language poet, he was part of this generation of whole poets who reacted against what he called the intrinsic evils of narrative, lyric, identity, among other constructions. So there were all these poets who basically reacted against this binary, lyric and narrative, by rejecting all of it, by rejecting the I, rejecting story, rejecting everything. But one thing I want to take from what Wendler brings up is this idea of time. That time is important. So that for her, the lyric self or lyric soul exists outside of time and the narrative self exists in time. Okay, so I want to argue, and I think it's important, then the most basic understanding of narrative is that narrative is time-centered in a way that lyric isn't. Lyric is language-centered. So one way in which people think about narrative, one way which it models time, comes after Aristotle. There's this idea of a beginning, a middle, and an end. But that's just one model, one structure the narrative can take. For me, the central gesture of narrative is and then. And then this, and then that, and then another. There can always be another sequel, another spin-off, another iteration or variant. Think of folk tales. They don't have a simple beginning, middle, and end. Instead, they feature heroes who have to overcome a series of obstacles. The structure is suspense and release. And it could go on and on and on, and then and then. So today's superhero films, for example, I often think have more in common with narrative as it's been historically understood throughout human history, than the three-act shaped structures of classical or realist theatre or film, which is modelled on that. Because the superhero stories exist in this continuum in which stories are told to kind of pass the night, by a fire. They don't comment on the human condition. They're not designed to do that. They emanate from humanness. I always think of that John Berger line about singing being like smoke, just a sign of human habitation. So lyric, being language-centered, doesn't exist in time in the same way. And by time, I mean linear time, and then, and then, and then. It's crucially independent of time and space. That's Wendler's phrase. So it can be written in the past or in the present tense. It can contain events and incidents, but those aren't its main quality. The way I think of lyric is like a kind of hull breach in a submarine or a airplane. What it does is it sucks all of language into a kind of small aperture. And as such, there's this sense in lyric that it couldn't exist in any other form. It can only exist in that way, with those specific words. Its emotion is tied up with its music. So think of someone. So I was thinking, who is the most definitive lyric poet? I think Gertrude Stein. I thought this would be appropriate because you'd be eating pastries at this point. So this is from Tender Buttons. Cutting shade, cool spades, and little last beds make violet, violet when. So it's just, it's pure language. If you took any of the, if you changed any of those words, it wouldn't be what it is. I mean, that seems pretty simple to me. Emily Dickinson as well, classic lyric poet. Again, all of the emotion is tied up in the music, in the specific choice of words. If you change any of those words, then it's not the it's not an Emily Dickinson poem. And I guess I chose this one, like a lot of her poems. They'll employ elements of narrative because a lot of them are building on the balladic tradition, in which there'll be a kind of vague story. So I'll just read this one because it's a really beautiful poem. I cautious scanned my little life. I winnowed what would fade from what would last till heads like mine should be a dreaming laid. I put the latter in a barn. The former blew away. I went one winter morning and lo, my priceless hay was not upon the scaffold, was not upon the beam. And from a thriving farmer, a cynic I became. Whether a thief did it, whether it was the wind, whether deity is guiltless, my business is to find. So I begin to ransack. How is it hearts with thee? Art thou within the little barn love provided thee? So much of the beauty of this poem comes from the like little weird language choices. Like I cautious, like not I being, I mean, obviously it's a lot of it is dictated by rhythm and how is it hearts with thee? Such an amazing phrase. And just as a kind of stupid way of showing that, I like fed it through a Latin, then Malagasy, then Russian language version. And it doesn't prove that much. Obviously, it just my inherent point, which is that if you change it, if you try and paraphrase it, it just becomes something different. In this case, I think actually the reason I share this is because I think it's really quite good, but it's an entirely different poem and good in its own way. Like, I love the ending. Start testing the oven. What a powerful, oh, small chicken eggs. Do you like? I mean, that, oh, and also the way it changed to my family and higher were brought for money from the, and lo, my priceless hay. Anyway, point is, it's not Emily Dickinson. And such as it uses a narrative structure, it's not really, its pleasure isn't related to that. Talking about narrative. So narrative, we think of as the more fixed thing, but for me, lyric is what is fixed. So narrative can always be rearranged, adapted, and still be recognizable. You know, there are variants, as I said, of Cinderella, Snow White, Little Red Riding Hood across, you know, all sorts of different cultures and traditions. Historically, these stories recur and they're changed, they're adapted. The story is always, this for me is a quality of narrative, separate from the telling of it. It can be separated, whereas in lyric, you can't separate the story from the telling. And I sometimes think of narrative is that you follow it like a kind of like an argument that you see in a house on the opposite side of the street at night. And the argument unfolds over different rooms as maybe the couple move around, they draw others into it, their children, the dog, they go into the bathroom, they pick up the phone, they shut the bathroom door, one runs into the garden, and you see elements of it happening, but you know that you're never seeing the whole thing, and that's the thrill of narrative. You're always just been given enough to want to see it, but you're always aware that there's more, whereas with lyric, you know that what you have is all of it, and if you lose it, then you've lost the whole thing. Okay, so a someone pointed out beforehand that I was talking about, I'm not talking about narrative poems so much as narrative in poems. And I want to talk about a few poems which kind of blur the line. So this is a poem by an American poet called Etheridge Knight. And he published his first collection, Poems from Prison, in 1968. He was really supported by Gwendolyn Brooks and was kind of part of that group of poets concentrated around there. And on the back cover, he says, it's kind of a really amazing description of coming to be a poet. I died in Korea from a shrapnel wound, and narcotics resurrected me. I died in 1960 from a prison sentence, and poetry brought me back to life. So without going into too much biographical detail, it's probably quite important that you know something of that. Okay, so I'm going to read this poem. As You Leave Me. Shiny record albums scattered over the living room floor reflected light from the lamp. Sharp reflections that hurt my eyes as I watch you squatting among the platters, the beer foam making moustaches on your lips, and two, the shadows on your cheeks from your long lashes fascinate me almost as much as the dimples in your cheeks, your arms and your legs. You hum along with Mathis. How you love Mathis, with his burnished hair and quicksilver voice that dances among the stars and whirls through canyons like windblown snow. Sometimes I think that Mathis could take you from me if you could be complete without me. I glance at my watch. It is now time. You rise silently into the bedroom and the paint, on the lips red, on the eyes black. And I lean in the doorway and smoke and see you grow old before my eyes and smoke. Why do you chatter while you dress and smile while you grab your large leather purse? Don't you know that when you leave me, I walk to the window and watch you and light a reefer as I watch you, and I die as I watch you disappear in the dark streets to whistle and smile at the Johns? So, I mean, it's quite an unsettling poem because there's a strong implication that this person, the you, is a sex worker. And it really brings out a lot of the speaker's possessiveness and voyeurism as I watch you. But there's something very, it's kind of why I gave the context, there's something very like raw and unguarded and guileless about it, which is, I don't know, it kind of draws you back into it. But the reason I brought it up is because the American poet Terence Hayes talks about it in this brilliant book called To Float in the Space Between, which is about his relationship with Etheridge Knight and Etheridge Knight's work. And Etheridge and Terence Hayes frames it specifically in terms of a narrative. And I wouldn't necessarily have thought of this as a narrative poem. But he quotes this academic and poet, brilliant academic and poet called Susan Stewart, who teaches at Princeton. She says that a narrative is a structure of desire, a structure that both invents and distances its object. And I thought this was a useful definition of narrative. So for me, that word object is important. If we think of the lyric as subjective expression, the narrative isn't objective, but it's focused on an object. So it's focused on, there's a sense of a space being created between the speaking voice and what's being described. So famously in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, Stephen Dedalus describes literature as following this kind of progress, this ascent from the lyrical, which is the simplest verbal vesture of an instant of emotion, to the dramatic, at which point the artist fills every character with such vital force that he assumes a proper and intangible aesthetic life. So there's this idea that the lyrical is the most subjective, the most personal. It's just like a cry, a raw cry of kind of pain or of song. And the dramatic is a kind of emptying out of the self. And so the dramatic, the narrative. And again, I think that's again like a kind of cartoonish idea of the lyric, but it's kind of important to hold that in mind. So the lyric is subjective in that it can use objects, often literally, but it's centered around emotion. Whereas, you know, the objects, they swirl into its vortex, that kind of whole bridge image. Whereas narrative invents and distances an object. I think it's kind of useful to think of it like this. I often think of poems in this way. I imagine a kind of line between the subject, the I, and the object, the you. And this, or at least this, And this to me is quite a narrative way of thinking of poems. I kind of realized over this talk, because it's instantiating a space between the I and the you. Whereas in a lyric poem, I think this is often more what's happening. It's that little blue line, that blue circle is meant to indicate a kind of vortex. And there's this kind of hole in the middle, which is both the I and the you. They kind of meet. Whereas you get the sense in often poems which have more of a strong narrative element of this space between. And there'll be points in the poem which are more I-centered, more subject-centered, and more you-centered. Oh, yeah, yeah, no, I'm going to. They're kind of... It's a second one. So the poem I was just talking about, the Etheridge Night poem, to me that... It's all about the play, the movement... Ooh, do I have a light on this? Yes. It's all about the movement from the I at the beginning. So if we go... Well, let me go back to it. Nope. Ignore that. If I go back to it. So it begins in quite like, it begins with a lot of eye-centered reflections. The stuff that's near to the subject speaking. The shiny record album on the living room floor, squatting among the platters. And then we get a sense of the you creeping in bit by bit. Moustache, you know, beer foam moustache, dimples, Mathis. Until at the end, it's obsessionally you-based. It's all about watching the you as they leave, as they depart. And that to me is that's a sort of narrative progression. Okay, I'm just going to quote a bit more of what Terence Hayes says. I think it's really interesting. So he says that when Stuart invokes structure, she's suggesting that narrative itself has a shape. This isn't news. The 19th century German writer Gustav Freytag illustrated this shape, this narrative shape, in a diagram that's come to be known as Freytag's triangle. That's it. So Terence Hayes says, we learn the parts in high school English class. You guys might be familiar with them as well. Exposition, rising action, climax, falling action, and resolution, denouement. And Hayes says, I like to think of the structure as a line with a peak in the middle. The peak is the point of the story. And As You Leave Me is of interest in this context because Knight manages to suggest a narrative arc whilst omitting large parts of the story. It's these omissions that fuel my debates with Renegade, who's a friend of Hayes. It's those omissions that make the poem such terrific theatre. Knight concentrates on a particular slope of the narrative triangle instead of the exposition and climax. He clips all ordinary time around the moment, the courtship, the coitus. His poem narrates the moment of falling action just after the lover's literal, figurative, and structural climax and just before the lover's exit. So I think that clipping is really interesting. What distinguishes the Etheridge Night poem from pure narrative and what slides it towards lyric. So later in the book, Hayes also says, is lyric not also a structure of desire? Is lyric not also a structure that both invents and distances its object? I think yes, but obviously lyric and narrative have very different shapes. If stories are generally triangular, lyric is circular. Lyric, like longing, has no discernible beginning, middle, and end. It's always happening in the now. So that sense of always happening in the now to lyric, that feels important. And it goes back to my point about lyric being language-centered, a whole breach, which sucks everything into it rather than time-centered. So whether it's in the past or the present tense, it conveys this urgent nowness. But I disagree with Hayes, this idea that narrative is always triangular. For me, narrative is just defined by having a shape at all. Lyric doesn't need a shape. Often it can just be a gesture, like with Sappho, swerve of thought away. But it can be made entirely out of words, like with Stein. So this is just to illustrate the point that I think Hayes is making. So he kind of takes the pyramid, and we've got the climax, the falling action, and this is kind of where the poem takes place. And so it takes place just before the lover leaves, just after the climax, where we have a sense of there having just been a climax, and we're in the falling action, the slope. And time has been clipped. So we've lost the exposition and the rising action. We don't have any sense of how the relationship started, how it built to that point, And this is, and that's the kind of pleasure, the pleasure in the poem for us. But it's interesting that you can map it onto a narrative diagram. You can think of it in a narrative sense, and I don't think that's true of all lyric poems, that you can just fit them onto Freytag's pyramid. But I'm going to try with a couple. Okay, so just want to, okay, before moving on to another poem, just want to try and just try and sum up some of the three, I've been kind of vaguely gesturing towards three main contentions about narrative. So just to recap, I feel like, and I hope I haven't repeated myself too much, but narrative is time-centered and lyric is language-centered. Narrative is defined by a sense of expectation or premonition, and then, and then, and then, whereas lyric is defined by its presentness. Narrative is object-centered, whereas lyric is subject-centered. Okay, and now I want to look at another poem, which is a bit different. Got Freytag's Pyramid again, I don't know why. Okay. This is a poem I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, especially in terms of the climate, the environment, how to write about the environment, because it feels like the environmental poem, and the first, the originary, the one that people are still grappling with, consciously or not. And also it feels like the template for a lot of contemporary poetry, the arc of this. So it's Nutting by Wordsworth. And I'll read it. It seems a day. I speak of one from many singled out, one of those heavenly days that cannot die, when, in the eagerness of boyish hope, I left our cottage threshold, sallying forth with a huge wallet o'er my shoulder slung, a nutting crook in hand, and turned my steps toward some far distant wood, a figure quaint, tricked out in proud disguise of cast-off weeds, which for that service had been husbanded by exhortation of my frugal dame. Motely accoutrement of power to smile at thorns and brakes and brambles, and in truth, more ragged than the need was. O'er pathless rocks, through beds of matted fern and tangled thickets forcing my way, I came to one dear nook unvisited, where not a broken bough drooped with its withered leaves, ungracious sign of devastation. But the hazels rose, tall and erect, with tempting clusters hung, a virgin scene. A little while I stood, breathing with such suppression of the heart as joy delights in, and with wise restraint voluptuous, fearless of arrival, eyed the banquet, or beneath the trees I sat among the flowers, and with the flowers I played, a temper known to those who, after long and weary expectation, have been blessed with sudden happiness beyond all hope. Perhaps it was a bower beneath whose leaves the violets of five seasons reappear and fade, unseen by any human eye, where fairy water breaks do murmur on forever. And I saw the sparkling foam, and with my cheek on one of those green stones that fleeced with moss under the shady trees lay round me, scattered like a flock of sheep, I heard the murmur and the murmuring sound in that sweet mood when pleasure loves to pay tribute to ease, and of its joy secure, the heart luxuriates with indifferent things, wasting its kindliness on stocks and stones and on the vacant air. Then up I rose and dragged to earth both branch and bough with crash and merciless ravage, and the shady nook of hazels and the green and mossy bough, deformed and sullied, patiently gave up their quiet being. And unless I now confound my present feelings with the past, ere from that mutilated bower I turned, exulting, rich beyond the wealth of kings, I felt a sense of pain when I beheld the silent trees and saw the intruding sky. Then, dearest maiden, move along these shades in gentleness of heart, with gentle hand, touch, for there is a spirit in the woods. So do you remember the stages of the Freytag triangle? This is me mapping Nutting onto that. So you've got the short exposition, this kind of once upon a time like opening, which locates our story in childhood, boyish hope, and it pinpoints the exact moment in the past, this repetition of one from many, one of those heavenly days. And it suggests, we already know, a sense of premonition that something important is going to happen on this day. And then we have all of this rising action. Most of the poem is taken up with rising action. You know, the boy sallying forth, getting dressed up, tricked in his weeds to look like a vagrant. coming to this nook, finding, you know, this perfect scene with like clusters of nuts, and then it builds and builds. He's like absolutely loving it, laying his head down on the moss, everything, you know, this Edenic scene. And then we have this climax, this ferocious climax, where he, for no reason, though we've been prepared for it, we know that something's going to happen, he deforms and sullies and just ruins this idyll. And then we have a very swift resolution. Then Dearest Maiden, move among these shades. Okay, which kind of explains the, I guess, the moral of the story. Touch gently. And so if you try and map it on a Freytag triangle, it kind of, this is how I imagine it. So remember the shape of the last one? So rather than it being a perfect triangle with the falling action, we don't have any falling action. We've just got the exposition and then lots and lots of rising action, then a sudden kind of cliff drop of a climax, and then a little resolution at the end. So this, to me, this is the structure of nothing, and it's also the structure, I think, of a lot of contemporary lyric poetry, which borrows from narrative, essentially. We'll have this sense of something important being about to happen, and then it'll happen, and then the poem will end. And usually lyric poems today won't have the resolution, they won't have the bit which explains what we've just seen and why it's important. Okay. The line, rereading it and thinking about this talk and about narrative, which really hit me, was, unless I now confound my present feelings with the past. So that to me is the crux of this poem. Unless I now confound my present feelings with the past. So it's the bit which tells us that this is a poet in the present, a speaker in the present, looking back. It tells us that this moment that happened was the turning point. It says that this moment has stayed with them. It suggests this whole intervening space, this distance between subject and object, between this moment in time and the present moment. And what makes this poem different from a lyric poem is this time-centeredness. It's always its sense of confounding the present and the past. And I feel like a lot of lyric poems will do that, but this is actually trying to stage it. It's trying to show in the action how the past feeds into the present, how it can still be relived. So you can almost read that moment at the end as being like the whole breach. So when the mutilate about, and you can read, and it's where the moment, where the emotion of the poem just is sucked into it, and it's easy from that point to almost read it as a lyric poem, or to be left with a lyric sense of it, to be left with the overwhelming sense of a single person's feelings. But what's interesting to me is the way it imitates and uses the structure of narrative to create that. It stages it rather than just showing it. Okay. What I thought would be interesting to look at now would be, rather than a narrative poem, because narrative poems I thought about using are actually very long, and they would have been really, I would have spent a long time just reading out, I don't know, a section. I'm really obsessed with Aurora Leigh. I could have read out a lot of that and tried to do justice to it, but I think that would have been hard. So I thought I'd talk about a short story by Alice Munro. And there's one story which I particularly love called Differently. It's from her 1990 book, Friend of My Youth. And it has this incredible opening. Okay. These are the first three paragraphs of this Alice Munro short story. Georgia once took a creative writing course, and what the instructor told her was, too many things. Too many things going on at the same time. Also, too many people. Think, he told her. What is the important thing? What do you want us to pay attention to? Think. Eventually, she wrote a story that was about her grandfather killing chickens, and the instructor seemed to be pleased with it. Georgia herself thought that it was a fake. She made a long list of all the things that had been left out and handed it in as an appendix to the story. The instructor said that she expected too much of herself and of the process, and that she was wearing him out. The course was not a total loss, because Georgia and the instructor ended up living together. They still live together in Ontario on a farm. They sell raspberries and run a small publishing business. What's so amazing about this opening as well, it's just so perfectly contained. And we don't hear anything else about the instructor / current husband. He's not named. So it feels like it's like in like old poems when they have a prologue or a poem which kind of explain what the poet or the writer is trying to do. They set out their kind of ars poetica. This feels like Alice Munro setting out her stall, and then she just moves on to a story which is almost entirely separate from this. It wasn't, you know, which wasn't at all necessary. It feels like that. Doesn't it ring true with a lot of poetry workshops as well? Like, what is the thing? And also the story about her grandfather killing chickens, which she just was like, I actually did once try and write a poem about killing chickens because I also felt like I needed to write something that was more authentic, because it's a thing in Indonesia that you kind of divine the future from the guts of a chicken. Something I'd never experienced, but I felt like I needed like a good workshop poem. Anyway, so this particularly resonated with me. And I imagine with a lot of, in fact, the index she mentioned, all the things that have been left out, reminds me, I don't know if you know Marianne Moore's amazing second collection, Observations. It has this appendix at the end, and it's a fake appendix. And I remember the first time I read it, I actually thought it was real and went through looking for beavers, thoughtful, beaver, skin, bow with muff, swan like an iceberg, swan like a battleship. Those are all entries in this appendix at the end with like fake page references. And yeah, it's, and I feel like she's making the same point which Alice Munro is making. It's a kind of like concession to what is left out by lyric poems, by focusing on an individual thing, on a pangolin and not on a beaver. Because each lyric poem, like this urgent nowness, has to pretend it's the most important thing in the world, or that this moment was the turning point, the most essential thing. And there's always a tacit awareness that that is a kind of fakery. It's a game. And one thing I particularly love the way that the instructor says she expects too much of herself and of the process. So it's this admission that Georgia may be right, you know, that stories and poems can only do so much, that we've got a limited time to make an impression, and if you want the reader to pay attention to anything, you've got to say one thing. It's almost like what kind of marketing executives say, just say one thing and repeat it 5 times. And that of herself as well, that even as people, we have to just double down on the most important thing if we want to leave an impression, that that we'd go kind of mad trying to do justice to and live with the kind of too many things that happen in our life. And that's where narrative comes in a way. Narrative is a way of streamlining things. It's a structure of desire that invents and distances the object. So it makes sensible, touchable, seeable, the object, the important things. It gives us a coherence, a shape to our life. But the kind of ironic thing about this, of course, is that Munro doesn't write stories about grandfathers killing chickens, and the story that follows isn't about that. What she does, though, is contain these kind of lyric moments within her stories, kind of like Etheridge Knight, kind of like Wordsworth, but she switches, she toggles between the lyric and the narrative. The power of them comes from their embeddedness in time, in linear and then time. So indifferently, as with lots of Munro stories and how well you know her work, the pleasure and the sadness comes from the manipulation of time, skipping back and forth. She does this amazing thing. She'll always, often in parentheses, something will happen. It will be like an everyday incident. Someone will be like crossing the road, and then they'll and then there'll be a parenthetical aside, which will be like, you know, years later she would ask why he did that or something, or, you know, years later after he died, she'd like, I don't know, spit on his tomb. It wouldn't be that graphic. But you suddenly have this kind of jagged sense of present feelings confounding the past. And she's incredibly good at that. Okay, so what I thought I'd do, and the pathos in her stories, in fact, and in narrative generally, is this sense that the author is able to control time in a way that the characters, the speakers, can't. They're chained to the events that define their life. Okay, so with a little bit of time left, I thought I'd just tell the story of Alice Munro's story, because I haven't really told a story, and I feel like in a talk on narrative, it's probably quite important. just to think about what difference it makes to embed a lyric moment within a larger story. So this is the story of Differently. Sorry to ruin it for you in advance. So in the present day, Georgia has decided on a whim to take the ferry over to Victoria, which is where she and her ex-husband Ben, who was a naval officer, used to live with their two children. And as she goes there, she passes their old house and decides to drop in an old friend of theirs called Raymond. And Raymond was married to someone called Maya, and they formed this kind of tight little unit, Raymond and Maya and her and Ben. And Maya, we find out, died last autumn. So 15 or so years ago, when they were all this tight group of friends, there's also another couple who was part of it called Hilda and Harvey, who don't feature so much, they're not that important. She meets up with Raymond and she starts reminiscing about this time when they were all a little unit. She remembers the first time she met Maya. So Maya was hosting a dinner party, and Georgia had been told that Maya was clever, rich, and weird, so she expected not to like her. Instead, she was intoxicated. Georgia was intoxicated by Maya. Maya is imperious and free-spirited. She wears robes. She doesn't paint her toenails. She has affairs. And she and Maya start spending time together. While their husbands are at work, they go out drinking gin or to a hippie restaurant which serves brown rice with slimy vegetables, and they drink cloudy cider. And in the summer, when Ben goes on his yearly cruise with the Navy, Georgia gets a job in a bookstore. And she sits there and she looks across the straight avenues of books with all of their plausible promises. And when there's nobody around, she feels a sudden abundant sense of calm. And one day, working behind the till there, she meets a man called Miles. And he's a kind of motorcycle dude. And he gives her a lift home on his motorcycle, and they stop by the beach. And it's not dark, but it isn't even deserted, but they sleep together. And they begin an affair that summer, which escalates quickly. And one night, sitting in Miles' car, this kind of make-out point, lots of other cars, they have an argument. Miles is being forceful, and Georgia rebuffs him, pushes him back. And the next day, Georgia's at home, and she gets a call from Maya. And Maya says that Miles, the motorbike dude, has asked to see her. Maya says, you know, she'll clear it up and she'll call back as soon as he leaves. So Georgia says, okay, that's fine. And she stays up with her kids watching TV, and she starts getting increasingly anxious. She does something about Maya. She's always loved her, been intoxicated by her, but she's never really trusted her. And she gets increasingly anxious as she waits for the call. And eventually, she can't stand it, she leaves the house. She leaves her kids in their beds, leaves the door open and the light's still on. And she drives over to Maya's, circles the block. She can't see the motorbike, but she doesn't really feel reassured. She goes home. And the next morning, finally, she gets through to Maya. And Maya, first, she tries to play it off. Georgia, you in a state? She asks. But soon, she admits, she can't hide it, that she and Miles did sleep together. But it meant nothing, she says. It was just scotch and opportunity. But from this point on, Georgia shuts out Maya. She doesn't speak to her again. She says Maya comes in one day and begs her, but Georgia just cleans all the appliances in her kitchen, doesn't say a word to her. And later, Georgia goes abroad, she sends her gifts. Sorry, Maya goes abroad, sends her gifts. Georgia takes a vengeful pleasure in denying even the acknowledgement of Maya's guilt. And then the next year, Georgia tells Ben about the affair with Miles and leaves him. And the story then cuts to the present day. Georgia is still sitting with Raymond. Raymond's bragging about his new wife, his new job, his life. And Georgia suddenly feels this sense that it was a mistake to have stopped at Raymond's house and decides to leave. Raymond wants her to stay longer so they can talk about the old days, about Maya. And he offers her a lift to the station, but she'd rather walk. The late afternoon light is lovely. He gives her a hug, and then he gives her a long, chilly kiss. His appetite, grievous and unconvincing, a parody of passion. But then as she walks away, she isn't thinking about the kiss. These are the last two paragraphs of the story. She doesn't think about that as she walks back to town through the yellow-leafed streets with their autumn smells and silences, past Clover Point, the cliffs crowned with broom bushes, the mountains across the water, the mountains of the Olympic Peninsula assembled like a blatant backdrop, a cutout of rainbow tissue paper. She doesn't think about Raymond or Miles or Maya or even Ben. She thinks about sitting in the store in the evenings, the light in the street, the complicated reflections in the windows, the accidental clarity. So, I feel like I'm kind of running out of time. So I did have a conclusion here, but I feel like maybe it's clear enough without drawing it out. Yeah, without drawing it out. This is, a lyric poem. The difference between a lyric poem on its own and embedded within the story within linear time. Anyway, thank you for your time.
Thanks.